Hey there. You know, you can take out Latino and more with you anywhere you go with the NPR One app. NPR One finds you the best from public radio and beyond. Election essentials, local stories, your favorite podcast, your favorite local NPR station. NPR is ready to make a trip, waiting online, or waiting for a friend, much better. Find NPR One in your app store. From NPR Music, this is Alt Latino. I'm Felix Contreras. This week, we turn to books, specifically something that I've been obsessed with lately, Latino noir. Stories that involve crime and the people who solve those crimes. Stories about the darker side of life and all the things we enjoy from noir, but with a Latino bent. With us today is writer Carmen Amato, author of the Amelia Cruz novels. Carmen, welcome.
Thank you, Felix.
Okay. Those classic noir films from the 1950s always had a certain visual and musical aesthetic, like small group jazz with ballads, lots of tenor sax. So I think I'm going to try to establish a Latino noir musical aesthetic.
Oh, I love it.
With this track. This is from an album called Nocturne. It's by jazz bassist Charlie Hayden and the great Cuban pianist Gonzalo Rubalcaba and Joe Lovano on tenor saxophone. This is called Claro de Luna. And when we come back, we're going to talk about one of my favorite detectives, Amelia Cruz. But first, this music. Joe Lovano on the tenor saxophone with Charlie Hayden on bass, Gonzalo Rubalcaba on piano, and the great Ignacio Perroa on the drums. Again, we're in the studio with Carmen Amato, author of the Amelia Cruz mystery novels. And so without further ado, let's get right into Amelia, because she's one of my favorite detective characters.
I'm so glad to hear it.
Oh my gosh, I really fell for her in a lot of ways. But tell us about her.
Well, Amelia is the first and only female police detective in Acapulco. And it's today's Acapulco, where the crime rate is very high. The city is a plaza for drug rival cartels, very lucrative routes into the U.S. So I wanted to create a character who could be a character for all mystery readers, not just Latino mystery readers, not just U.S. mystery readers, but I also wanted her to be a vehicle for informing folks about what's happening in Mexico today. So where could I place such a character? Acapulco, it's an iconic city, it's a beautiful city, it's one of my favorite vacation spots, violence notwithstanding. So by putting her as the first and only female detective, she would be taking on not only the drug cartel violence, but the whole culture of machismo in Mexico. And I felt like I could really do a lot with that character.
How many novels is she part of?
I project probably about 15.
Awesome.
I hope so. There's a lot I can do with that character.
Well, as you mentioned in the stories, there are quite a few obstacles in her way just to get her job done in solving crime. We want to talk about the real life crime in a second, but talk to me about her. Like, where? How did she get wrapped up in police work, and how did she become a detective of all things?
Well, in the books, being a detective is the top of the game for her, and it's also the highest salary she could make, she feels. She grew up as the only child, with her mother suffering a near constant nervous breakdown after the death of her father when Amelia was a toddler. So she grew up in an extended family with her father's brother, his wife, and children. Those two cousins of hers, both boys, became cops, and she followed them. So somewhat of a family tradition, but also she didn't see that she had many opportunities. She tagged along with the brothers, and so that's how she came to be a uniformed cop first. And in the prequel, readers can see how she literally had to fight her way into the detective squad room. But that she was aiming for the top of her career, the most money she could make, and she's there.
Even when she gets into the squad room, as you mentioned, there's still quite a few obstacles, especially in an area of Mexico where a lot of old school traditions still ring true and still hang on.
Absolutely. And readers tell me that some of their favorite scenes are the ones with her arguing with her partner, Franco Silvio. He becomes her partner in the second book. And in the first book, he tells her, "I'm going to make life so difficult for you, so miserable until you leave, because I never wanted a woman in the squad room." And her reply is, "Ugh, tell me something I don't know." And they are going to bicker for the next 15 books.
That's part of the magic of that, of those two characters, because you can expect it, you know, but out of that bickering, there's quite a bit of respect and admiration.
There is. It's been slow on his part to germinate. Mm-hmm. And he's never going to come out and say, "Hey, you're the greatest partner I've ever had, and I'm so glad we're in this together." But he is. Silvio is at the center of much of it, and the ending is very dramatic between him and Amelia. Oh, okay. No spoilers. Spoiler alert.
Okay, Carmen, let's talk about noir in general very quickly. Like, what is it about that genre? That sort of existential meandering, there's all this really kind of dark thoughts. What draws you to it?
I don't know, because I've never been a big puzzle maker. I think it's the personal challenge of putting characters in difficult situations and weaving together multiple storylines. I don't like books that are very linear. Here's the mystery, here's the bad guy, here's the arrest, we're done. I like things to be complicated, and some of my favorite authors do that, and I read to learn from them. And so I've tried to do that, but put a real Mexican flavor to it.
One of the things we're going to do in this show is we're going to drop in music, but we're also going to drop in some excerpts from some readings from some other authors that are writing in this Latino noir genre. And you brought in four that are all on my top 10 list. So
they should be.
So tell us a little bit who we're going to hear from first.
Well, first I think you're going to hear an excerpt from Ernesto Malo. He's an Argentine writer, and he's really has a very powerful series. It's Inspector Lascano, who is a police inspector during the military junta era in Argentina. So he's got some very dark, very dramatic issues that form the backdrop to his stories. But he's got a beautiful, fluid manner of writing. I was really captivated. He uses an interesting device when he's writing dialogue. It's all cast as in italics rather than using conventional quotation. And it creates this intimacy as if you're reading their thoughts, which is usually how italics is used in writing.
This reading is from his book, A Needle in a Haystack, and it features some of that brilliantly dark, introspective writing you just talked about. And it focuses on one of those backdrop stories, the sudden death of Inspector Lascano's wife, Marisa, and the emotional turmoil it creates for the character. This reading and the others we'll hear in the show will be performed by Washington, D.C.-based actress and performer Marisa Armona Ruiz.
There is nothing like a well-timed death. When movie stars die at the pinnacle of their careers, before the aging process has reared its ugly head to disappoint the fans, they stay on top forever, suspended in popular imagination, adored in life and idolized in death by the masses. Like Gardel dying in the plane crash. Like Marisa. She died at the very moment Lascano loved her most. A traffic accident. Simple, quick, brutal, irreparable. She left, and every comfort, every happiness, everything went with her. Everything lost. At first, the shock had stunned him, left him disoriented, detached from reality. Then a blind fury awoke in him, directed at everyone and no one, but mainly against himself. Then her absence became a knife to the chest, twisting deeper by the day. He was unable to resign himself to his fate and began to regret his lack of religion, finding himself wanting to believe in a God he could blame and curse. He fondly contemplated his pistol, picturing his brain splattered across the bed, so incomplete without Marisa. This was when Fuseli stepped in. He read the symptoms and saw where they were leading. On the pretext of having nowhere to live, Fuseli asked if he could stay with Lascano for a while, a favor to a friend. Not having the strength to say no, Lascano fell for the trick, which would later save his life. Fuseli took charge of protecting Lascano from himself. With perfect patience, Fuseli brought him from the depths of despair back to the surface where life absurdly continued. Lascano recovered because his friend gave him something to believe in, something to hold on to. Fuseli appeared to Lascano's sense of justice, and Lascano clung on, in desperation, to what became his mission in life, making the world a fairer place, even if only a little. A bit ridiculous, perhaps, but as good a lifeline as any. Mission accomplished, Fuseli went back home, back to his solitude, leaving Lascano to his.
Next up is another one of my favorite guys, Gus Corral from Denver, Colorado, written by the talented writer Manuel Ramos. And Gus is my man. He's just bumbling along.
I love Gus's character. And it's so amazing to introduce Gus as this near-do-nothing living in his wife's junk shop. Ex-wife's junk shop. That was brilliant, just to make that the central character. The books by Manuel Ramos really have a great edge of humor to them in terms of who the characters are, but also he puts you into their thoughts, and it's got a wry quality to them. A wonderful writer, an awarded writer, definitely someone to really immerse yourself in, and he's really a terrific author.
This is from a new book by Manuel Ramos called My Bad. This scene features our hero, Gus Corral, okay? He's an ex-con, he's in a sticky situation, and he's with his lawyer trying to explain it all to the cops, who are represented by a formidable Latina community liaison officer.
Ana Dominguez surprised me. Actually, I wasn't sure what to expect, so I guess anything would have surprised me. The woman who sat behind a very organized desk in her office at the old city and county building oozed confidence. Nice clothes, tasteful makeup, serious attitude. She was about my age, my height. Hint of a smile, but heavy emphasis on playing the cop role. A framed photo of four Mexican-looking men sat on the corner of a bookcase. Nothing out of place, nothing unnecessary to her job, except for the photograph. The city big shots who'd created her position did all they could to make it clear that she was different from the rest of the department. The first thing I noticed was that her office was not in the police building. Positively not my type. So naturally, I was attracted. And not just because I'd been locked up for years with low-down, mean, and insane hostile men. Luis Montes sat in the chair next to mine in front of her desk. He stayed out of the first part of the conversation. I did most of the talking since it was really my story. Her face told me all I needed to know. She went from curious to amused, to shocked to something like disgusted.
Let me get this right. You're on parole. You saw a murder?
No, I didn't, actually. She quickly nodded.
Correction. You saw a dead man who died because of an apparent violent attack, but you did not report what you saw to the police or...
He's reporting it now, Anna.
Montez finally chimed in. I thought you guys were friends, I said. She grinned while she looked at the lawyer.
Not exactly, she said. But in any event, you did nothing when reporting the crime to the police might have made a difference.
The guy was dead. Nobody could have done anything for him, I said.
No, but maybe the murderers might have been arrested if the police were involved at the beginning.
What I saw was the end of something, not the beginning. And anyhow, I understand there was no body in the house, so who knows for sure what the police might have found.
We'll never know, will we, Mr. Corral?
I shrugged. Look, I just wanted to do the right thing. I hope I sounded sincere, even a bit naive. I probably should have called you or some other cop when I saw what I saw. I didn't. I waited a long second. My bad. She stared at her well-manicured hands and shook her head. I can't undo my screw-up, I continued. You do what you have to do. It's your job. I guess my hard-ass parole officer will yank me back in the joint. Maybe I should have just kept my mouth shut and let the police department stumble around. Until maybe they bumped into something that might lead them to think there was a body in that house before the fire. That last part came out slicker than I intended.
I love those wisecracks from Gus. He cracked me up. Okay. You know, I discovered Manuel Ramos in a great anthology that you should know about. It's called Hit List, The Best of Latino Mystery, and it's published by the great folks at Arte Publico Press in Houston, and it is a fantastic introduction to this way cool genre. Like I said, I discovered Manuel Ramos in that book with a funny story about Pancho Villa's stolen skull. Something you got to read to believe. And another writer I want to point out that is in that book is Lucha Corpi. She's a Chicana from the Bay Area who's writing in this book and then in her own books sound like jazz to me. You got to check her out. You know, the Hit List anthology is a really important statement about Latino noir. And I also want to point out a fantastic noir series from the publishers Akashic Books in Brooklyn. Now, they started with a book of stories about Brooklyn, and it was so popular that they expanded it to other U.S. cities and then to other cities in different countries in the world. Their Mexico City and Havana noir books are also great introductions to writers working in both of these cities. The book about Havana features one of the best crime writers out there working today, the great Leonardo Padura, one of my top five in the genre. And I see by their website that they just published San Juan Noir, in both English and Spanish. And I also see some anthologies coming from Bogota, Sao Paulo, and Buenos Aires. This is an amazing indulgence for sure for people who really like this style. In fact, our next story comes from their Mexico City noir anthology. This is called Violeta Doesn't Live Here Anymore by the Mexican writer Miriam Laurini. And I really enjoyed the sense of anguish she gets from a guy who may or may not be guilty of killing his wife.
I got up at 6 in the morning, like I do every day, Monday to Friday, and on Saturdays when I have to work. Then I do 10 minutes on the treadmill and 10 minutes on the stationary bike. Then I bathe, shave, and dress. With my tie still undone, I made my way to the dining room for breakfast, pretty much on automatic pilot because routines become automatic, or life on automatic pilot creates routines. What do I know? I didn't smell coffee, or huevos rancheros, or even fresh squeezed orange juice. I thought Violeta was still asleep, and I was going to have to make do without breakfast. When I got to the dining room, the light was off. Violeta's asleep, I said to myself, and cursed. I was in a hurry, and it was dark, and it was 6:30, and though the bank was only 4 blocks away, I had to check in by 7 on the dot. Otherwise, I'd lose my eligibility for the annual punctuality award. On my way out, I inadvertently stumbled on a chair and whatever was on it. I hit it with my knee and cried out. I can't explain it. In an instant, everything rushed to my head like a crazy hurricane, and I somehow knew it was Violeta. I ran to turn on the light. I saw her, and the gasp from hitting my knee was quickly replaced by screams of horror. She was tied to the chair with a cable. I couldn't bear to look at her, and I ran out to the street, scared out of my mind. I paused at the door, and my screams turned into a professional mourner's lament. I don't know how much time passed, maybe a minute or two. It's just that in situations like that, minutes become an eternity. That's when Lalo Cohen showed up. He's a neighbor who goes running in the park every morning at the same time. "What's the matter, Miguel?" Lalo asked. I tried to answer, but I couldn't. No matter how hard I tried, choking up my sobs and shaking all over, I couldn't get a single word out. I started to scream. Lalo plastered his hand over my face. That is, he slapped me so hard my head rattled, and I'm actually grateful because I think it might have been the best way to rid me of my hysteria. "What's the matter, Miguel?" he repeated harshly. She's dead," I mumbled. He was getting angrier, and his voice was even more harsh. "Violeta," I said with a steadiness I didn't really feel. "Violeta, are you sure? That can't be. I was talking to her just yesterday afternoon. That can't be." "I didn't kill her. I didn't kill her. I didn't kill her," I kept repeating, and Lalo squeezed my arm so hard he almost broke it. "You're being hysterical. She must have just fainted. Calm down," Lalo said, and pushed me away from the door. "Come with me and stop screaming." I decided to follow my neighbor's orders. Hanging on to the walls in the hallway, I went in after him. As we came to the dining room, I covered my eyes with the arm he'd almost broken. "Chucha madre, they killed her," were Lalo's first words. On the second ones, "We have to call the police." He went for the phone, and I stumbled to the floor, falling right next to Violeta, and lost consciousness. I don't know if I was awakened by the pain or the pluff, pluff, pluff of Lalo's slaps. Whatever it was, it made me leap away from the dead woman and scold my insensitive neighbor. "Why are you hitting me, you beast?" He acted as if he'd been caressing me. "Come on, you have to rise to the occasion. I'm going to the bank. I'm already late." "You're not going anywhere. The police are on their way and you're going to have to give a statement," he said without any sympathy. I began to shake again and started repeating my refrain. "I didn't kill her. I didn't kill her. I didn't kill her."
Oh, man, the next part of that story places this guy, who may or may not be guilty of killing his wife, in front of a really sadistic police inspector. And then you just got to go out and buy the book, all right, and check it out. Again, that is from the book Mexico City Noir. This story is called Violeta Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Okay, next up, Carmen, another one of my top five crime writers, Latino or otherwise, Paco Ignacio Taibo II, P-I-T or P-I-T in Spanish.
Paco.
Paco Ignacio Taibo II, probably Mexico's greatest crime writer.
And certainly a prolific writer. He has a series, and there aren't many, to have a mystery series with a continuing character set in Mexico City. He has the series set in Mexico with the protagonist, a private investigator, Hector Belascoran Shane.
Okay, this next reading is from his book, No Happy Ending, a book that starts with him discovering a dead guy dressed like a Roman soldier in his bathroom, which sets off a deadly set of occurrences that put him in the crosshairs of a bunch of people, including two guys who try to ambush him and his office mate, El Gallo.
"Get out of the way,"
Hector said to El Gallo when the two men took out their guns. They were 12 yards away, coming towards him across the street, dodging paperboys loaded down with stacks of today's news. El Gallo smiled at Hector, and it wasn't until he noticed the gun in Hector's hand that he turned sharply to see what was the matter. A paperboy with a 3-foot stack of papers loaded on the back of his bicycle pedaled in front of Hector. His balance was precarious, and Hector pushed him off and grabbed the bicycle by the rope that held the papers in place. The first shot hit the stack of papers. Thousands of words flew in all directions, leaving the smell of fresh ink in the air. El Gallo separated himself from Hector, and a long-barreled Colt revolver appeared in his hand. The bicycle wobbled and fell over, and Hector let himself be pulled down behind it. As he fell, he sighted down the barrel of his gun toward the belly of the greasy-haired man, but he hesitated as a woman crossed his line of vision, carrying a small boy in one arm and a stack of papers under the other. A second bullet ricocheted off the pavement, leaving a hole in Hector's jacket. The paper hawkers ran for cover, and the gray-suited man was left in the open in the middle of the street.
Another shot sounded. Hector fired at the same time, and the man clutched his stomach with both hands. The detective fired again. Blood spurted from the man's chest, and he fell over backwards. 3 yards to the right, Greasy Head lost a precious second watching his partner go down. When he turned back to locate Hector, a piece of his jaw exploded, and his face became a bloody grimace. Hector hadn't had time to fire. El Gallo stood behind La Prensa pickup truck, smoke curling from the end of his revolver. Shouts and cries filled the street as the echo of gunshots faded. The screaming had started when the first shots were fired, but Hector hadn't heard it, only the sound of shots and the soft hum of the freely spinning bicycle wheel behind which he'd taken cover. Suddenly, a silence descended, and the only sound was from the traffic a block away on Bucareli. Then someone started to clap, and others joined in. Surrounded by applause, Hector approached the two bodies, while El Gallo covered him, like a gunman out of the novels of Marcial La Fuente Estefania. They were both dead. One of the men stared skyward through his dark glasses, his two hands still trying to plug up the hole in his stomach. The other bullet had probably hit him in the heart. He laid in a huge pool of blood. Hector took off his dark glasses and stared into his lifeless black eyes. The other man's face was a bloody mess. Hector checked his pockets, just a few pesos, and an ID card from the subway police. It was the same for the other one. Hector had blood on his hands, and he wiped them off on the dead man's pants legs. The crowd of paper vendors gathered around, ignoring the detective's .45 and El Gallo's Colt, forming a circle with Hector and the two corpses at its center, and El Gallo still aiming over the La Prensa pickup at its periphery. Now that the shooting was over, they seemed entirely unafraid. Maybe because this was their stock in trade, just another story for tomorrow's paper. Maybe because blood flowed every few days anyways between Donato Guerra and Bucareli, in knife fights, fist fights, fights with broken bottles. Or maybe because they decided that Hector and El Gallo were the good guys in this particular story. Curious children hovered around the bodies, and the three men were already arguing over the guns that had fallen to the ground. Hector left to join El Gallo. I killed him, didn't I?
If you hadn't shot him, he would have gotten me. I guess I owe you one, pal.
I killed him, didn't I? Repeated El Gallo.
Yeah, you killed him, and I killed the other one. And it feels like crap, I know, even if it's in self-defense.
And then finally, something by you, Carmen Amato, from the novel Hat Dance. We get to hear a little bit from Emilia herself.
This excerpt that I chose for you is one of readers' favorites. Hat Dance is the second book in the series in which Emilia is fighting to catch a violent arsonist and also find this missing teen, Lila. Well, she's already survived a fire in a restaurant. And in this excerpt, a demonstration in Mexico turns violent and a fire erupts in the demonstration. And her reaction is to run. And Silvio, her partner, manages to catch up with her, and the scene is then the discussion between the two of them as to what happened. It really sets up the love-hate relationship between the two of them and has some of the toughest moments between the two of them.
Footsteps sounded on the sidewalk, and Silvio was there, face streaming sweat.
For Christ's sakes, Cruz! He bent over and drew in air. What are you, some kind of flipping Olympic runner?
Emilia couldn't have replied if she'd wanted to. She started to shake, her body churning with adrenaline and the residue of incomprehensible fear. Silvio grabbed her by the upper arm. He pulled her down to the street, to a small loncheria, and tossed her into an orange vinyl booth.
What the hell, Cruz? He said hotly. I must have called you a dozen times. You forget radio protocol?
Emilia blinked at him. Her teeth chattered like castanets.
I turn around and there you go like a freaking speed racer, Silvio said in disgust.
The waiter put down two glasses of water
and a pad of paper with menu choices on it. The car turned into a big wall of fire, Emilia said, her voice shaking as much as the rest of her. Always smart to run away from a fire, not into it. Away! Silvio mopped his sweaty face with a paper napkin from the table dispenser.
This is it, Cruz, said. I never wanted you in the squad room. Sure as hell never wanted you as a partner. You are living proof that women can't do this damn job.
Emilia started to laugh. Silvio was lecturing her with the same old crap he always said, and her teeth were clacking together, and all she could do was laugh. It wasn't even funny. She didn't know why she was laughing, but she couldn't stop either. Maybe it was because her teeth were making so much noise inside her head. Clackety, clackety, clackety. Silvio threw a glass of ice water into her face, and Emilia stopped laughing. The tourist at a table across the aisle gasped. The cold water ran down her chin and soaked the front of her jacket. Silvio grabbed a bunch of paper napkins from the dispenser and thrust them at her. Emilia slowly wiped her face. The napkins came away damp and sooty. She dropped the soggy paper, lunged across the table, and slapped Silvio. He leaned back, but even so, she connected hard enough with his jawbone to send a jarring sting up her entire arm. The tourists scrambled out of their chairs and herded themselves toward the door. Silvio fingered the bright red mark that Emilia's hand had left, then snapped his fingers at the waiter and ordered two beers. Emilia blew her nose on a napkin. It came away laden with black muck. The waiter put two cold bottles on the table and darted away. Silvio upended his bottle and took a long guzzle. Emilia swallowed a mouthful of cold beer, grateful for the cooling sensation as it went down her throat.
Just how bad was that fire at the El Tigre? Silvio asked after a while.
Worse than I thought, Emilia said.
The other thing I enjoy about Emilia is that she's a contemporary woman, and I just knew that her music tastes would somehow strike a chord with mine. And who is her favorite band?
Maná.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
right?
I think there's, in some scene, she's wearing a T-shirt from the band.
And so we get to play some Maná on Out Latino.
Oh, what did you pick?
I picked one of my favorite songs that I hope is one of hers, and you'll have to tell me. It's called Eres Mi Religión, and hopefully she would like it as much as I did.
I can't wait to hear it.
Iba caminando por las calles empapadas en olvido. Iba por los parques con fantasmas y con ángeles caídos. Iba sin luz, iba sin sol, iba sin un sentido. Iba muriéndome, iba volando sobre el mar con las alas rotas. Ay, amor, apareciste en mi vida y me curaste las heridas. Ay, amor, eres mi luna, eres mi sol, eres mi pan de cada día.
You know, I picked this song because after reading the books and getting to know Emilia, you know, she is a woman. She has desires of for romance, and she's in this tough job that is so hard on family life. And yet she's going through these books, and without giving things away, you know, she tries. There are hits and misses. And that's what this song reminded me of. It's like a deep-seated desire for this really kind of perfect love, perfect relationship.
Oh, I think you nailed it. I could picture her thinking these lyrics in regard to the hotel manager, Kurt Rucker, who is her lover. Their relationship has a lot of tension to it. She has a difficult time committing, and she has a difficult time sharing thoughts with him. So I'm enjoying writing that, I have to admit.
And this song takes care of that.
It does. Excellent choice.
Carmen Amato, before we close out the show, one last question about Emilia Cruz, since we are going to hear more from her. Like, what do you think she represents to Mexico, to women, to writers, to you? What does she represent?
Emilia represents hope that there are good people fighting the law enforcement fight in Mexico, and that they will ultimately prevail. That's what I want her to represent for the reader, that she doesn't give up. She's going to keep fighting for the rights of the women who are missing, for justice, for cleaning up. So I hope that when readers put down a book, once their heart goes back to normal, that they feel like, okay, you know, things are going to get better. Things are going to get better in Mexico.
Carmen Amato, author of the Emilia Cruz Detective Series, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a real pleasure.
And tell Emilia I said hi.
I shall.
Thanks again to Washington, D.C.-based actress and performer Marisa Arbona Ruiz, who did our readings today. You can find longer versions of those readings on our website at npr.org/altlatino. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We are NPR's Alt Latino. I'm dying to know if you know this genre, if you have favorite writers. Let's talk about it. And before we go, I want to remind you to listen to NPR's newest podcast, The Big Listen. If you're looking for something new to hear, in addition to Alt Latino, of course, you can find The Big Listen on the NPR One app and npr.org/podcast. Check it out. Support your local podcaster. This, of course, is your favorite podcast. This has been Alt Latino. I'm Felix Contreras. Thanks for listening.